The basis for what I'm presenting to you today came from a paper that I wrote for one of my doctoral courses on evaluating quality of care in healthcare in general. And so because I was interested, of course, in CAM and in acupuncture, which I am, I really focused it on how do we evaluate quality in CAM care. In my BU School of Public Health, not everyone is familiar with CAM, so this slide was basically to offer some compelling reason about why it's important to study quality in CAM. A lot of Americans use CAM. Even some of these statistics are probably just a little bit dated now, but you know, there's an enormous, at least $27 billion, which is probably an underestimate, is being spent in out-of-pocket expenses. And a year ago, about two-thirds of managed care organizations were actually offering CAM options. So what I wanted to do was actually look through the literature to try and get a sense of what kinds of studies had been done in CAM in terms of evaluating quality. So not so much as looking at clinical trials or looking at specific context, but just get kind of an idea about what's the whole range of quality assessments and how have colleagues envisioned what is quality. So, by doing that, I wanted to get a state of the art, you know, what was the pulse on quality assessment in CAM. Now, if any of you are health services researchers, these two frameworks, at least one of them, will probably look familiar to you. These frameworks, one from Donna Beadian in 1966 and the other one developed a little bit later in 1994, look at ways that we can evaluate quality of care. Now, if we think about just looking at an outcome and say, you know, for some of us here, we work with people who have a condition that we're not going to cure. So we're not going to cure HIV or AIDS, or we're not going to cure a spinal cord injury, but we're still hoping to give the highest quality of excellent care. So how do we evaluate that in the context of what is quality? So we can't just depend on outcome. And that's where Donna Beadian's framework, has anyone ever heard of Donna Beadian's framework? Okay, great, a few people. Back in 1966, not CAM researchers, but regular health services researchers were faced with the same kind of dilemma. You know, as chronic illness was becoming more and more of a centerpiece of, you know, the American healthcare focus, and we're getting away from, you know, having to deal with infectious diseases that can perhaps be quickly treated with an antibiotic, and we're looking at longer term illnesses, how could we evaluate quality in some kind of meaningful way? And so he developed this structure, process, and outcome. And I'll give you some examples of how this plays out. More recently, two investigators, Stiles and Mick, developed their three-part assessment, which involves looking at technical aspects of care, interpersonal aspects of care, and amenities. And we had studied both of these systems, and I thought that perhaps how we could, you know, in a more holistic way, which we want to do as CAM researchers, incorporate some of what our forebears had learned. So in the Donna Beadian framework, now this top line quality, it's based on three aspects: the structure in which care is given, the process in which care is delivered, and then the outcome. And so they all make contributions. And so I wanted to give an example of what constitutes structure. So the kind of an institution, you know, it might be inpatient or outpatient or home visit based. Structure is related to the qualifications of providers and issues like licensing. So, you know, when we go around and we're looking at a new facility, no matter whether it's CAM or whether it's a nursing home or some kind of inpatient facility, we look at, you know, are all providers appropriately credentialed and licensed, and, you know, is there a process for that? So that would be one aspect of, you know, related to structure. Process is basically how is care delivered? You know, what is that intersection of the provider and the consumer? So it's the types of procedures that are done, the kind of training that goes into providing those, and then documenting that. And I'm sure that for many of you who deal in the world of healthcare provision, you know that oftentimes it's the documenting that the angels and the details of what we do, that we not only have to do the care, but then we have to somehow substantiate that in a documented form, whether that's hard copy format, whether it's electronic format, we have to somehow document that, and that's an important thing. And then outcomes included traditional things like morbidity, mortality, did someone live or die, and then cost. So those were some of the aspects of the Donabedian framework. In Stiles and Mick, their three quality indicators had to do with technical, interpersonal, and amenities. And you'll see that there are definitely some overlaps and relays with this. So in technical, how would clinical resources be applied? And ideas like institutional affiliation and governance, and you know, what is the, you know, kind of the organizational chart of an agency. So all of that would go into this technical aspect of it. Now, I don't want to give you the idea that these are the only ways that we assess these indicators, but I wanted to just provide some examples so that it wasn't completely coming out of the blue here. The interpersonal is one that I'm sure we can relate to in terms of the art of healthcare, and that's the real interchange. It was, you know, those four hands on the slide, you know, being able to really connect and have some type of meaningful communication. And this also has to do with psychological and social needs of patients. And then lastly, physical environment of care. A few years ago, we had a very active SPIG member from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and her doctoral work and real interest lie in the surroundings of care. So what should hospitals be designed like for optimal healing? You know, are current designs adequate to what we really want to do? And she had some very interesting work. I hope she'll come back soon. So what I did was kind of take these two frameworks and see where they crossed and interacted. And so top is our Donabedian structure, process, outcome. Left side, technical, interpersonal, and amenities. And I tried to see what are our intersections between these two. And then this matrix would be how I would assess the literature review that I did of CAM quality literature. So basically, with me so far on this. So basically, what the cells within this matrix give are some examples. So I didn't want to exhaustively list every single example, but it gives you an idea for how we might start thinking about things. And this really, the process of doing this literature review really did affect my practice as an acupuncturist in the agency where I work, because we started thinking about evaluating quality in a more holistic way and not just kind of looking at single unidimensional factors. So the intersection of technical and structure might be something like provider credentialing. So when we're evaluating quality of some type of agency or service, that would be something we look at. For structure, interpersonal, availability of chaplains or advocates or some kind of patient-centered intersection. Amenities has to do with conveniences. And one of the amenities that we have been really striving hard to provide at where I work is to have daycare, so that when moms come in for their acupuncture treatment or they're seeing the shiatsu person, that the kids actually have a place to go. And so it's an amenity that would actually promote utilization. So it's a structure amenity, something to look at. In terms of process, some of the ideas here were treatment planning. In CAM, as far as I can tell, the idea of planning treatments and kind of structured treatment plans, it's an idea who it's incubating and it's not quite there yet. The more that we can enlighten this area, I think the better it will be for the public who's receiving CAM care, and certainly it will make the process that we're doing a little bit clearer for ourselves. process interpersonal caregivers team approach. And the team may be kind of an interdisciplinary team. We might consider social workers, bless you, other quality of care, perhaps a case manager, our healthcare providers. The more that they can work on it as a team, the better the outcome and the higher quality of service that we're going to provide. And then process amenities, good example of that is a short waiting period, because I am sure that none of us in this room likes to be told, well, your next appointment, you know, you can get is in February, and that's going to be at 8:30 at night. You know, that's not what we want to hear. We want to hear you can come in as soon as you need to come in, and that's at a convenient time for you. Outcomes for technical change in health status. That might not only mean, you know, did we cure somebody, but what kind of improvement or change did we make on their health daily status, activities of daily living perhaps, quality of life, or indicators that are related to their actual healthcare challenge. Outcome interpersonal, patient satisfaction with something like communication with provider. Did you feel that your provider listened to you when you answered their questions? Did you feel that your concerns were given the attention that you wanted? So something like that would be an outcome interpersonal. And then outcome amenities, patient satisfaction in terms of the comfort of the experience and just the context of that. How well did that go? How well did you feel taken care of? And you know, your overall assessment of that. So I set out to do this literature search. It was not a meta-analysis. It was not on that level. But I did use a couple of search engines, National Library of Health and PubMed. And I used an assortment of key phrases and words, and I mixed them up in all combinations. So quality assessments, outcomes, process indicators, adverse events, the thing that none of us like to think about but we all have to deal with. CAM, integrative medicine, complementary and alternative health. So I put these together in all possible combinations. And I was able to find about 150 articles that dealt with aspects of assessing quality in CAM care. There were 42 that I was able to find in structural issues, 31 in process-related topics, and the big area that seemed to be, you know, have most of the articles was definitely on outcome assessment. The other way that I found these articles was once I would start to identify articles, I'd look in their bibliography and citations, and so that would lead me to more. So it wasn't exhaustive, but I felt that I had a fairly good finger on the pulse. So in those outcome articles, adverse events definitely were the big one, and you know, I have to say it was very hard to read all of those adverse events happening in acupuncture. Things like needles that are not sterile, spreading hepatitis, needles that go into the lungs or penetrate other organs, these kinds of adverse effects, things that we don't want to read about. 5% of the articles actually dealt with malpractice issues. There were about 20% of the articles patient satisfaction, and then changes in health or functional status or provider surveys for the rest. Process measures, the ones that I found, about half of them had to do with diagnostic accuracy, treatment planning, team approach. It was very interesting to see that. And practice guidelines, something that I know many of our traditions are in the process of developing and actually for some evolving. Some of the articles had to do with record keeping. One had to do with provider profiling. Structure-related measures that were important to look at in these articles, qualifications, licensing. About 15% of the articles that I found on this topic had to do with architecture and design of facilities, design of healing environments, and 5% had to do with amenities. And so when I looked at it in the bigger picture, just graphically, this is kind of what it came up with. So really heavily outcome-oriented, and I think we would expect that. I'm not really at the point yet where I think, you know, we need to change what we're looking at, or, you know, I have a set percentage that I want to put out there, but I'm hoping that we can actually start some dialogue about this. But within structure, process, and outcome, these were the kinds, these were weighted in terms of how many articles dealt with those in each of those areas. There was one really good article. You know, it was one of those things where you say, gee, I wish I had written that. Thank you. It was on quality profiling in CAM and the example of a traditional Chinese medicine hospital in Germany. And I would really recommend this for those of you who are either interested in hospitals and how to incorporate CAM, or if you're interested in traditional Chinese medicine, or if you're a health services researcher and you're looking at quality. These folks did a beautiful job. It's in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, 2003, issue 9, volume 2, 193 to 206. And if anybody actually wants the bigger paper that this came from, let me know. And just to briefly go over this, it's a TCM hospital in Germany, 76 beds, and it is a really meaningful collaboration of physicians and Chinese acupuncturists and herbalists. They use ICD-9 codes as well as traditional Chinese medicine assessments. Referrals are made by primary care physicians, and throughout the stay of hospital time, there's actual ongoing conferring between these two groups. So there's really a team approach. And in this setting, as long as treatments and outcomes are measured and reported, public health insurance will cover it. So that's kind of an interesting little way of looking at that. They organize in detailed areas of structure, process, and outcome. They give you a very intensive profile of the infrastructure of this hospital. And quality assurance is an ongoing, repetitive activity that they do. They routinely assess quality of life, and they're actually able to do follow-up up to a year after discharge. I mean, that is amazing. I mean, whether you're interested in CAM or not, being able to follow up folks after they've been through your clinic or through your study is just something that is mind-boggling. But these folks really did it. So in summary, just not just for this article, but for the whole review, the literature, I was pleased to see, does contain articles that are relevant to quality of care assessment in CAM. There were many more articles than I expected, and that was really a great thing to see. So people are concerned about assessing quality of care in CAM. But what I noticed is that the articles were what I call unidimensional. So they would consider one aspect on that quality matrix. So there'd be a focus on structure and talk about that, or a focus on outcome and that. And there was a big emphasis on outcome-related indicators. Where I think this might go, other than starting a dialogue with researchers and CAM providers, is that more of our research should be focused on issues related to health services. So just as important as it is to conduct clinical trials, it's also important for us to be evaluating other aspects of care as it is provided in the real world. And NCCAM, which is the part of NIH that is concerned with complementary and alternative medicine, in their most recent five-year plan does say health services research is an important way to go. And basically health service research looks at things like quality assessment, utilization, cost effectiveness, who uses services and why, how satisfied are they. It's another big umbrella. And when we're doing evaluation of our services, we should consider taking a holistic approach. Perhaps the quality matrix that I pointed out there is not the ideal one, and I haven't tested that or haven't really brought that to any other levels. But as we're assessing quality, to be able to think in a few different dimensions holistically in the same way as our medicine goes. I just want to thank Boston University School of Public Health for giving me the opportunity to do this and to be here with you to present it. So, thank you. And we've had a great group of panelists today because we not only stayed right on point with time, but we've really freed up some time so that we can have some discussion. So, any places to get started? Yes. see if I can actually bring this over.
That's what I'm attempting to do here. She asked when we did the analysis whether or not we adjusted for the fact that the light touch first group had higher pain at baseline, and we did. And like I said, I'm not an analyst, so I'm not good at explaining all of that. I actually have some of the analysis with me if you'd like to see it. But when we looked at the analysis, and also one of my colleagues, Melissa Sendroy-Terrell, is also in the audience, and she's a little better than I am. But we did, various phases of analysis where we compared the baseline. You know, we tried to adjust for baseline and for the fact that they had more pain to start with. So that didn't make a difference. I mean, no matter how we analyzed it, it was still true that the people improved more while they were getting light touch than when they were getting massage. And the blinding did not seem to work. Which, the truth is, we would have only expected it maybe to work in the first 2 weeks, so the first period, because then they didn't have anything to compare it with. So they, believing that they were getting one of the two treatments, it's possible that they could have been confused, but by their responses, they weren't. So the blinding did not work.
One of the things I appreciated about your study, in working with other folks who are using massage and kinds of physical therapy, sometimes what I've heard posed as a comparison treatment is something like Reiki. And I know Reiki practitioners, you know, say, well, what do you mean? This is not nothing. You know, just because we may not necessarily be touching the body or doing an active intervention doesn't mean it's nothing. And so what your study did was really show some creative approaches to how do we have some meaningful comparison. It was really great to that. And I think it's been a point brought up at some of the other meetings that it's so critical to have CAM providers part of study design teams so that we don't run into situations where, oh, we never thought of that, or, you know, maybe because a researcher may not realize that with Reiki or with another type of treatment, it's an active intervention. And, you know, we need the providers to be stating this and not have assumptions be made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What type of an impact occurred for the nurses who learned to do the squeeze massage? Did that change any of their interaction or ongoing care for patients?
Okay, the question is, how did it affect the nurses that were involved, and did it change some of their practice? And that is something that we're still looking into, but I would say it definitely changed their practice. And in fact, that's sort of an ongoing discussion in the facility, is whether or not we will train more nurses in the technique. And because what we find is that a lot of those nurses went on to use that technique with their patients, especially at night when they couldn't sleep. They would go in and they would do that technique, and they continue to do that. And other nurses know that they're doing it, and they want to know how to do it. And some of the patients will ask for it because they know that those nurses know how to do that technique. So, and in general, that's what, for me, I mean, if I can just kind of speak off the record, is difficult about this project, is because if you look at it analytically, no, we did not prove our hypothesis. But as a facility, we look at it, and we look at what the patient response was and the nursing response, and we still think we may have a protocol or a treatment that can be incorporated, you know, on a daily basis by teaching nurses to use that technique. It would have been great if it would just have been an overwhelming statistical success, but we still think there are successes there, and there's certainly lessons to be learned.
Yes.
Right. It's not actively being circulated as yet. We've started using it internally where I work, but we haven't. Right. We're starting to look at that. Yeah. Right. Right. You can get an early version of the paper. Thank you. Yes. Question back there.
Are you asking
yeah,
me? Or?
Yeah,
okay, how soon did we do follow-up on what? The treatments were done on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and the patient was interviewed every single day.
Every single day.
But the interviews were conducted around noon every day. So if they would have had a treatment maybe like at 6 o'clock the evening before, and then the interview would have been done the next day. Which brings up a very valid point of how long, you know, even if the treatment lasts, how long does it last? Because even if you take an aspirin, you don't expect to have the effect the next day. We used the patient health questionnaire 9, which is called the PHQ-9, which has, I think it's called 9 because there are 9 different assessments and they're asked to rate. And so that's a tricky thing too, because usually you say that you're assessing depression symptoms versus depression, because unless you're a psychologist or you have certain training, you can't diagnose a person as having depression, but you can diagnose them as having depressive symptoms. And that's how we assessed that. And we used it at the end of at baseline, at the end of the first 2 weeks, at the end of washout, and at the end of the study at 5 weeks.
Yes.
I wonder if Dr. Cantor could talk a little bit about, did you see any applications of your model in assessing spiritual health in either individuals or communities? Do you think that's a wise thing to do?
Well, that's the whole purpose of having done this work. Is that, do you want to give me a little more of a question? Do you want to expand the question just a little bit?
Sure. I guess I'm working in a community hospital setting.
Okay.
Did a needs assessment of our Chinese community a couple of years ago.
Interesting.
We discovered that people, these are relatively new immigrants from mainland China, and that there's really not much spiritual support. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I thought, in this needs assessment, I thought, well, is it possible to assess the needs of this, the spiritual needs of this community, mm-hmm. or the spiritual well-being? And I wondered, is that even an appropriate thing to be doing? I mean, if you say this community is unhealthy spiritually, it's sort of like, sounds like a really arrogant thing to say. You know, we assess the relative physical health, but is that something that we could even want to move toward?
Your thinking is exactly what brought me to this interest to start with. I just finished collecting data on a second study, and this study, Sentara is our corporate ownership in Virginia Beach of the hospitals, and Sentara was looking for, as part of their Plaintree initiative, I don't know if you've heard of Plaintree, but they were looking for a spiritual assessment tool. To date, I've gathered about 3 pages of just references of existing spiritual assessment tools, and again, what you find is that it's difficult to determine how they develop those tools. You know, is it based in a particular religious group, or does it represent a certain theology? And although this conversation that was presented today is just beginning a discussion, I think it's a really valid and important discussion to have, and that the structure that I'm presenting as spiritual needs ultimately began because I wanted to know what people in alternative medicine were saying. I wanted a deeper discussion about what do they mean. You get a lot of head nodding when you speak to people that do alternative medicine or that receive an alternative medicine. There's an intuitive knowing. They say, spiritual health. But when we look at that in the context of providing a health care, we don't really know what that means. And so I worked with a chaplain on this last study, And it became evident to me that it was very important that people, at least in the inpatient center setting, be redirected back to their cultural origins, i.e. Chinese, you know, the group of Chinese that you're speaking about. So, and it was also a part of my doctorate that I did a literature review that took a year.
Oh.
A full year.
That's how long they take.
It took a year. That I took this basic structure, that the development of the structure began trying to understand alternative medicine, but it was amended when I added to it ideas from psychology and world religions and tried to put that languaging together. So in this literature review, I was able to find it had to be a major instruction or a theology, a major component of each religion, and this data was presented at the American I presented at the American Psychological Association, their division of, they have a psychology of religion division about 3 or 4 years ago, and that you can see when you use, it's English languaging, but with the languaging you can see these specific interventions from each religion. So your question asked, say it one more time for me, I'm sorry, I got
it. Would you see applying this to
community-based assessment? I hate to answer questions sort of off the cuff. My background is in healthcare, and I think it's really important to have an interfaith approach in healthcare, and that's really the focus of what I've done, is to say if someone is in a healthcare setting and they present with a particular spiritual need, how do we route them to their authoritative source for that need fulfillment? And I think, you know, also I bring what comes to this discussion is a better articulation of what alternative therapies provide for those spiritual need fulfillments, whether or not people choose to engage in alternative medicine or they choose to engage their religion of origin, that at least we can wrap some words around what we're trying to accomplish. Is that a good... Okay.
Sure. And another question for you. I know that most of the world's religions were pretty underrepresented.
Yes, they were.
Did you look at all at whether there was a difference in agreement between Christianity and other religions, and do you have plans to look at this in populations that are more diverse?
I have the opportunity. It's not currently in process. I have funding.
On the verge.
It's a promise.
Absolutely.
Yes. Because, you know, I guess from my culture and...
Tell me your culture.
Where I'm Arabic Christian.
Yes.
And I have a lot of faith.
Yes.
And through my faith, I can, you know, engage my mind and body. And that's what I used to do all my life. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with it. So it helps a lot in different, you know, going through different things in your life.
Yes, exactly. You're accurate.
And, I feel it helps a lot with the patient. Because I was a little physician. That when working with the patient, it comes about very good approach to the patient. When they trust you, they engage, and then it helps a lot. So it's not a very structural way, that's why I'm looking into all of this, but I want to structure it in a way that I can help patients.
Beginning. The second survey that was completed this summer, you know, like I said, Sentara asked me to make a spiritual health assessment based on these 7 spiritual needs as they saw value in the application, in interfaith application. I think it's more or less a cultural transition than it is Now we document in our nurses' notes that we provided active listening. You know, that's not really where I think it needs to go, but now you're asking me personal opinion, you know, not scientific representation. I think it's a cultural change.
About this problem also.
It's difficult to research. Strongly disagree, undecided, agree, and strongly agree. So the percentages that you saw were a combination of agree and strongly agree.
Right. Did you consider, or perhaps did you ask if your respondents if they would change anything or add anything or more kind of a qualitative assessment? Because it seems as though if you're trying to build a definition or kind of agreed upon
right.
That input from the folks that you're asking to agree with these or not agree
right.
with would be really helpful.
Second study. This study was merely trying to get some numbers, trying to get engagement with a large population. So second study is interviewer assessment in patient setting. And open-ended questions.
Great. And perhaps I missed this also, but was it
870? We went after 1,000 and ran out of money.
What was your sampling plan? Did you ask people to just self-select?
No. There's at Old Dominion University, they have it's called the Social Science Research Center. This is people use this center at Old Dominion University for other purposes like marketing, or you know, when they do large surveys, they pay this organization. And so beyond writing the being involved in the writing of the Likert scale, it was turned over to the people that have their own selection process of how they determine what telephone numbers they would call, and it's a random selection process. Yes, we call it the Hampton Roads area. It's about six or seven cities around Norfolk, Virginia.
Do you think if you had done the same thing, say, in Bronx or San Francisco, you could get...
I think I would get a more interesting population. I think it would be more diverse.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that would change your outcome as much?
Do I think it would change... Well, I don't know. Let's find out.
Another army.
You know, I don't want to give too much of a historical background here, but I remember when I was working on my MPH in the late 80s, and one of the first studies came out about the value of prayer, and most of the students in that class were physicians. And as we were reading this scientific article in a peer-reviewed journal, all they could do was be critical and not take it seriously. And to, you know, be able to have the caliber of the work that you're discussing today and the interest that we are having is really a tribute to the spirit of the people that can triumph over some of these antiquated ideas about what's health. So it's something, I think everyone heard that, about quality in terms of
communication between providers. This is an interesting point. In the center where I work, we're integrated into a community health center where we offer acupuncture and Chinese herbs and shiatsu. And we just moved into that site several months ago. And we took a year before we moved there to figure out how were we integrating. And what was a challenge to that very communication process was things like HIPAA. You know, what can we say to who when? And whose signature do we have? And so we waded through that morass for a long time, and I wouldn't say we're out on the other side yet. We've tried to develop, you will appreciate this, a very simple checkoff that we can give back to the physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants to say something about, yes, we're seeing your patient so-and-so, and we've got a treatment plan, and they're being taken care of. But trying to foster that kind of dialogue is important and also challenging. Any other?
At our clinic, we're always eager to interact with other providers, especially MDs and nurse practitioners. We find that that there's a reluctance on their part until there's a problem. On the Western provider's part, until there's a problem, whether it's if there's a research study going on or client care. Until there's an issue or a problem, we generally don't hear from folks. We're pretty much ignored. And it's unfortunate for the patient's sake, because patients end up being the... what do the patients want? That's what we understand.
Yeah.
That's what we understand, and that's what we hear. And so we charge patients with taking information back to their providers, providing information in hand, whether it's about herbal formulas. Please take this back and have this. Ask your physician to put this into your file. We generally, when we make up a treatment plan for a client, they get a copy of that either for themselves or they can take that back to their provider. So we make extra efforts in that direction all the time, partly because we see ourselves as community educators, and that means for the wholeness of the medical community besides our patients. And we have community education as well, and we consistently invite other providers to attend that.
And I guess I would add something, and that is, as a rehab facility, even though I think that our physicians are fairly supportive, they don't integrate very well with some of the CAM practitioners that come in. I mean, in that they just don't have an interaction with them. But the one thing that the CAM practitioners do is they always record notes in the patient's medical record. So their information and what they're providing is always available for the Western physician. And they have access to that medical record, so they too have access to the care and what's going on with their patients. What we have talked about, though, is trying to find a way that they're incorporated more so. So, for instance, in doing the rounds, I can't tell you if the rounds are every day or once a week, but routinely there are rounds for the patients in which all of the practitioners, all the therapists come together and discuss what the goals are and where that patient's going. And it would make more sense if that patient has an acupuncturist or a masseuse that person's incorporated in that meeting as well. And my understanding is, as of right now, they're not, and we're looking for ways to make that happen. Now, of course, part of that does come from the fact that the physicians are not our employees. The other therapists are, and the CAM practitioners are contractors. So you always have these kind of who can do what. You know, it's not exactly a HIPAA issue, but it's who can do what and who's authorized to do what.
You know, and just to add to that, that at our satellite clinics, as we move into electronic files, having the shared chart there is making a difference. I think that's a big difference. We're moving on that one.
Yeah.
I can get started with some of that. Some of the managed care organizations in this country have started incorporating some CAM services. And, you know, this is really a very broad brush thing, so we can get more specific with the other panelists. But some of the managed care groups are looking at where's the most evidence-based information and going with those kinds of treatments or using treatments only in a certain context. In the clinic where I work, we're involved with a managed care organization, and we're authorized to treat people for pain, headache or migraine, menopause or menstrual difficulties, and cancer-related chemotherapy side effects. So that was what the managed care company said, well, we've got evidence for that, we'll go with that. You know, the NIH says this is true. The World Health Organization gives an indication that this is a reasonable application for acupuncture, so they will go with that. I think because pain is so highly prevalent in many situations that when there is evidence-based information supporting a use of a CAM therapy, that is one that managed care organizations will start with. So I'm sure there's more to that answer.
That'd be where I would get started.
Do you want me to say something?
Oh, I said you wanted to say something.
I could.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're right. I agree. You know that there are reimbursement is the name of the game. I was just going to say that it's very market driven.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't it surprising that we're talking about LD 2020, and we are not looking at what could keep the population healthy, we are still looking at how to minimize the impact of disease. Mm-hmm. And this is where the role of CAM is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a huge role in that area. Mm-hmm. We are not, because we are restricted by insurance.
We agree with you.
Out what the there are multiple answers, I think, too.
Can I give an answer?
Absolutely. Okay. So I think what we're seeing that's new for physicians is the JACO recommendations, where patients are evaluating their physician. You're aware of this? It's a start, because when the disease model begins to shift, as you're saying, back to we really need to pay more attention to patient satisfaction. And what are the indicators of patient satisfaction? They go back to their communication with their physician? Did they feel that they were cared about? Were they offered the amenities that you talk about? And all, you know, I can point at everyone's research up here that says that there are ways that patients respond and that make them have feeling on the feeling nature that they are being cared for well and that they know how to feel healthy from the experience as much as from the medical intervention.
Switch it to that.
And taking that to sort of like a political and policy level, in San Francisco, speaking in terms of HIV care, this last year we lost all funding from HRSA, from the federal government, to provide care for complementary care for people living with HIV. So we were at this in a dilemma, and so what we decided to do was take that conversation of wellness and wholeness and care, sort of base that on surveys and outcomes of satisfaction that we'd done over the year, and we kind of held the supervisors hostage around that. And we and we organized patients to go and speak about how their level of health and wellness was increased and remained more stable, both physically, mentally, and spiritually, whatever their experience was, in order to maintain a certain level of funding for their care. And it was remarkably moving, and the main thing about it was real. And so people were talking about how it is they're able to maintain levels of medication, be more stable mentally, maintain their medications, but a higher level of wellness as opposed to just chasing symptoms, which we do every day, to maintain wellness. But people took it to another level and also spoke about being able to stay out of hospitals, you know, remain in work, and all the good things that helps, you know, support economics in people's lives living with a chronic illness. And we got our funding because of that. But it was a hostage-based thing, and we really went to the higher moral level of, you know, this city has tens of thousands of people living with HIV. Over 600 people a year get treated in this clinic. How are you going to support this number of people in wellness? And unfortunately, economics rule in those kind of conversations, but I think we always have to just go to the higher moral ground, or at least sew it in really tightly. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Well, there are two more activities between today and tomorrow that